sun bothering you?
No. This is tape one, side one of a recorded interview of Irvin I. Rubin in his home in Brooklyn, New York on February 26, 2002. The interviewer is James G. Trainum. Mr. Rubin, for the record here, would you please state the exact date and place you were born and the names of your parents?
I was born in Brooklyn, New York on February 27th, 1919. So in 2 days, tomorrow I'll be 83 years old.
And the names of your parents?
My father's name was David and my mother's name was Libby, L-I-B-B-I-E. Her maiden name was Rabinowitz, R-A-B-I-N-O-W-I-T-Z.
What was your father's occupation?
He was in wholesale dry goods. The way the immigrants worked, my father came over when he was probably about 17 to avoid the 7-year draft by the Tsar's army. And I don't know, unfortunately, too much about him here, but he ended up with in a wholesale dry goods business. What would happen was these immigrant peddlers would go around, because times were different, from door to door selling all kinds of merchandise, and then they would come back weekly to collect the money. And he sold dry goods, sheets, pillowcases, towels, beddings, and so on. So he would work very late because the people who bought worked in the daytime seeing customers, and they'd come in the evening to buy whatever they had to buy to deliver the next day.
Tell me something about your childhood, your early schooling, what your interests were.
Well, my childhood, I have a younger brother, 10 years younger than I am, and in effect I was an only child for 10 years. So I received an awful lot of attention from my parents, particularly my mother, who was born in Chicago, was a school teacher here, and had, I think, the honor of getting the first woman's driver's license. And there's a funny story there. My father in those days had a car, and we lived on President Street and Albany Avenue, and at the bottom of Albany Avenue, a long slope, was farmland. So she and her friend Veronica, who was my babysitter, got into the car, and they drove down Albany Avenue, but they didn't know how to stop. And they ended up in a muddy ditch on farmland, and the police, a policeman with a rope on a horse, had to pull them out. And he pulled them back up to where our apartment was. And I think that was the last time she ever drove a car, but she maintained a license till she was about 90.
And what was your schooling experience? Were you attending public schools in Brooklyn?
I went to public school 161. It was very good in one sense, because those days teaching was excellent. But I was considered a very smart student, and I skipped 3 or 4 times. And I really wasn't mature enough to really get the most out of the schooling. I would have been better off if there was an enriched program. And then when I was in my last class, they gave a test for Townsend Harris, which was a preparatory school for City College. And they did 4 years high school in 3. But the test was given on a Friday morning, and if you took the test, you didn't have to come back to school Friday afternoon. So if I could get a half a day off, I'd do anything. Though I liked school, though, without question. And I was admitted. And without sounding boastful, this is about the top 100th or even 1,000th percentile of the boys in the city of New York. And there was an automatic, I graduated in 3 years, that was 1934, and then I went to City College for 4 years and got out in 1938. But I got out of, it was a remarkable education, because at that time City College had more Nobel Prize winners per 1,000 students than any other college in the world. And you had an incredibly good faculty. And their idea was, they're not going to teach you how to make money in your vocation. You're going to learn that when you get out. They taught you how to be a human being. For example, every science student had to take art courses. Every art student had to take science courses. We had public speaking and so on and so forth. And when you graduated, you had to read, write, and speak a foreign language. And they always screwed you up unless you were really good, so you had to take the test 3 times. So by the time we were done, we had a good command. My language is French. And I don't know if this belongs in there, but it's a very funny story. The first time I went to Europe on business, I went on Air France. And the stewardess in those days, they were nurses, a very nice young lady, sees me reading the French newspaper. And she asked me questions in French, and I answered in English. She asked me why. I said I was embarrassed. Well, she said, if you speak French to me, I'll give you a big hug and a kiss when you get off. So I did. And after
she did.
I asked her, what was she doing for dinner that night? She says, a boyfriend is going to pick her up when she gets off the plane. That's somebody. There's another funny story attached to that visit. I went to one of the Hotel Georges Sank, which is the top hotel there, and I go in and I see the flusher isn't working right. So I take out my French-English dictionary, I get the words correct, and I practice it, and I pick up the phone, talk to the operator, and when I'm done, she says, yes, sir, I'll send up a plumber right away. I said, where do you come from? She says, Brooklyn. And she's at the Sorbonne, and working her way through, she was a telephone operator, working her way through college. That's how naive I was in the very beginning. But I learned a lot because we went, a very good friend of mine, Stanley Binman, also an injection molder, told me about mold making in Portugal. Portuguese are, if you remember Vasco da Gama, they've got a great history of exploration and science. And they were building molds, which I later, when I went there, much more efficiently and much better than in the United States, but at about a third less. So I would build all my molds there, and I'd go there about once a month, and I got to learn a lot about mold making, which American mold makers didn't know at the time. American mold makers would give one person the responsibility for the whole job, and you were at that person's mercy. In Portugal, the name of the company was Medio, E-M-I-D-I-O, Maria, M-A-R-I-A, D-A, Silva, S-I-L-V-I-A, and Marina Grande, M-A-R-I-N-H-A, G-R-A-N-D-E, which is about 60 miles north of Lisbon. They would do all the mold design in the design facility. And when that was approved, out came a series of drawings. The lathe hand did this, the milling hand did that, the grinder did that. So they could have a lot of people working on the mold. And when it was all done, there was a big pile of parts. And then the master mold maker would put them together, have under his supervision, and they would have molding machines to test it out. And the designer would be there at the test, so he would learn how it worked. And they did remarkable work. I had a... we made medical devices for Decnatel, D-E-K-N-A-T-E-L, which was later bought out by Pfizer and then was bought out by the people who was running it for Pfizer because they didn't make the same profit margin as drugs and it was bringing down Pfizer's bottom line. I made a mold there, one of the first molds I built there, that ran about 1.5 million shots without any maintenance, but simple polishing from time to time. And every mold they made was a real gem. And what we would do is, after the part was made, well, here's how it would work. I would send Emilio or his son, Rogério, who was an engineer, the print, we'd get a quote, and then we would quote it to the customer, and if we got the job, in about 1.5 weeks, I'd get a whole set of drawings. He would give it to one of TAP, that's the Portuguese airline stewardesses, and I would meet the plane at the airport and she would give it to me. Then, if there were any changes, I'd call them up, and we had a big piece of plastic which was lined and numbered A, B, C, D, 1, 2, 3, 4. So if I wanted to talk to them, I'd say, look at A5, and so on. And then I would okay the mold. And in okaying the mold, I assumed the responsibility. So the way we ended up doing it was my people and I made a checklist of all the things we want to look at in a mold. And the checklist is part of the addenda which I gave you. And then when it was okay, when mold was built, he would run it. If he had any suggestions, he would say so. And then either I or one of my friends who was also using him would check the mold out running. And then they'd ship it over here air freight. And we became pretty important. Pan Am was the carrier at that time, or TAP. And mainly I went Pan Am till they went out, then I went TAP. And again, it's another funny story. I had molds built in Spain, in Barcelona. And I was coming back on the Labor Day weekend, just before that, which is their busiest transatlantic flight time. And they gave me Barcelona to Lisbon to New York. I called up and I asked when the departure was, and she gave me 10:15. I thought 10:50, but it was 10:15. So when I got there, the plane was almost loaded, and I only had stuff I could carry with me. And I realized the plane was out there, and you had to go out by a car, you know, and climb up the plane. And I asked the guard at the door if that was a plane going to Lisbon. He said, yes. So I started to run. He said, you can't go. I said, I'm going. And he took his gun out and he shot in the air. And I started to zigzag like this. And they hadn't pulled up the stairway yet. The whole plane tilted to the side because everybody was looking out the windows to see what happened. I got there and I was exhausted. And I knew all the crew members by name because I flew in the winter. They were hysterical. So they gave me a seat in first class. They fanned me. And I got on the plane. Okay.
Well, those are very interesting accounts. They certainly occurred after you were well established. Let's go back a bit to your college days. Was it at City College, New York, that you got interested in science?
I was always interested in science.
You started that in high school?
No, I started before that in public school with a chemical set.
I see.
And I was interested in anything with the hands. I was interested in photography. I was very good as a carpenter. My father was an excellent carpenter. He would make boats for me when I was a little kid in the bathtub. I'd come out, my hands would wrinkle because I'd stay in so long. But I tell you how I got involved in plastic. I expected to be a chemist, and I realized that I needed a more information than a college degree. So I went for my, partly in the daytime, partly at night, I went for my master's. And I could
were
not...
Were you employed during that time?
No, I couldn't get a job.
Uh-huh.
And I finally was told by an old 30-year-old employment agency man that as a Jew I would never be hired as a chemist. Because in those days they just didn't hire them. He said, take any job. And what happened was my uncle, my mother's brother, was the largest importer of lampshades and lamp parts in the United States. And he was in Vienna when the Nazis marched in the Anschluss, and he knew there was going to be a world war. So the world war started on September 1st, 1939, if you recall,
mm-hmm.
And he went to, go ahead, take the picture. He went to Watson Stillman, who was the second largest molding machinery manufacturer in the United States at the time. Reed Prentice was first. And they gave him a turnkey operation, where they would provide him with the mold, the material, which was a Bakelite's polystyrene, and the molding machine. And all he had to do was press a button and start. He, lamp prisms, those are the things that you hang on a lamp, were made out of Czech glass. And he had handmade samples made in Lucite. And they looked as good as the glass. And once the war started, nobody could get them. So the turnkey wasn't ready, and he was selling them. And he had orders for millions of parts because it's just incredible how many parts were used. And they were 20 cavity molds. That means there were 20 parts, prisms made at one time. And they were 5/8 of an inch thick. and they molded the shot in polystyrene, and they had 20 bubbles. And no matter what they did, they had 20 bubbles. So he was getting a little desperate by this time, and after a lot of, this is now secondhand, after a lot of negotiations, the Bakelite sent down their chief expert. He would write on a piece of paper, we did this, 20 bubbles. We did this, 20 bubbles. And ultimately, he had a whole wall full of 20 bubbles. Then he came to the conclusion, and again, this is secondhand from the guy who's running the machine. If you have bubbles and you don't have, it's air. So if you got a vacuum, you wouldn't have any bubbles. So they built a rubber boot so when the mold closed, it was airtight. And they ran a 25 horsepower power line to the fourth floor, got a vacuum pump and an undersized tank. And they decided to do it. Now the operator says, how the heck am I going to get the parts out? And the engineer said very properly, first we solve one problem, then we solve another problem. The first attempt they made was, those days there was no need to make the mold airtight. So all the knockout pins were, you couldn't hold the vacuum. So they spent a week making new knockout pins, new holes, and so on. They put the thing back again, and there's a leak between the nozzle and the sprue bushing. And I assume, by the way, that you will have the information about how the machine works before this. So they took it out and they lapped it together. Then they decided to start it up next morning. It was late. They started up next morning, threw on the vacuum, and guess what happened? They sucked all the material out of the heating cylinder. It solidified. It must have hit the resonant frequency of the tank. The tank imploded and broke a couple of windows. Firemen and police were there in no time. Robinson shut the machine down, and that was it. He closed the plant and said, that's enough. And he went to Staten Island. He was a 7 handicap golfer. And he, it's a public course, they put two men with him. The first was a par 5. He was on in 3, and he 6-putted. The second was a par 3. He was on in 1, and he putted off the green. So the other two guys said, you know, it's obviously something is wrong. Without knowing their name, he told them the story of what happened with his plastic parts. I'm here because these were two of the 5 injection molders in the New York area. And one of them said, you're using the wrong material. You have to use crystallite, which is the Roman Haas acrylic at that time. Today it's plexiglass. And he said, I'll send you my foreman with a 200-pound drum, and you'll be running by noon tomorrow, which is exactly what happened. He wanted to send them a gift, and they said, no, take us out to dinner, which they did. And they told him that he has to hire somebody who has really good technical background because there's no place to learn it except by doing it, and they would be glad to train me if I had to. So they sent him one of their operators to run the machine, and he knew I was looking for a job. So he said, you want the job? I said, how much? He says, 12 bucks a week, minimum, 30 cents an hour. I said, look, I've got almost 2 college degrees, you know, I'm good with my hand, I'm honest, cha-cha-cha. He says, what do you know about lamp parts, L-A-M-P? I said, nothing. He said, what do you know about plastics? I said, I never heard the word, because I didn't know what he was doing. You know, those days, you didn't talk about those things. Well, he said, if you don't know the industry and you don't know the process, you're not even worth the minimum. But he gave it to me anyway. And that's my great knowledge of how I got into the plastics industry. And then what happened, everything grew from there. They had a dinner the first Thursday of every month, and they would drag me along, Robinson would, but he closed the door. The dinner was so successful, the 3 of them, they decided to invite the other injection molders there. And Mr. Robinson would drag me along. And when I was sitting next to somebody, and you're talking about what happens, and say my machine didn't close and I just fixed this valve and it worked. And they looked at me, you know, why? And I explained the circuit because I knew nothing about hydraulics, but I'm running a hydraulic machine. So I went to the library. That's the way we were trained at City College. I learned hydraulics, not a very complicated thing. So I would draw the hydraulic circuit for them. And every month I had something to say. Finally, one month I said to Uncle Sol, you're lucky, nothing went wrong today, this month. He says, make up something. And then afterwards, when the Society of Plastic Engineers, the New York section, was formed, naturally we all joined it. And who did they call on to talk? Big Mouth, who was talking all the time. This led to some very interesting results. Dr. Herman Kaufman, a very good friend, he lived in Jersey, was the chief of plastic research for Allied Chemical. And ever so often we'd have lunch together. And we were both bemoaning the state of ignorance because he was doing what I was doing in a different milieu of the people in the plastic industry. And together we came up with the idea of an all-day seminar. So we went to the SPE, that's the Society of Plastic Engineers, and they agreed 100%. And on a Tuesday, Herman gave the first all-day course on plastic materials, and on Wednesday I did it on injection molding. And it was so successful that it spread out to other subjects, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Why don't you tell me briefly just what injection molding involves so that there would...
I think the best way to do it is to take it right out of my description here. I've written it many times, and that with the drawing will give you, I'm sure, a pretty clear idea, and if not, pick up the phone and record it later on.
All right.
A brief description of injection molding. There are two types of materials. One is a plastic material, which once you make, you cannot reuse. That's called a thermoset, T-H-E-R-M-O-S-E-T. That is a formica would be one, urea formaldehyde would be one. The largest material used are thermoplastics, where you can heat the material up, melt it, cool it, and then if you don't like it, you can regrind it and do it all over again. In order to make it, you need four things actually. First of all, you need a molding machine. Secondly, you need material. Thirdly, you need a mold. And fourth, very important, you need management, because you can have all of those the best, and if you don't have good management, you won't make good parts. The purpose of the machine is twofold. First of all, it melts the material, and the melting mechanism today is a screw. Secondly, it holds the mold on the press, and it keeps the mold tightly shut while you're injecting the plastic material. Now, a mold is a very simple thing. Supposing you wanted to make a comb mold, you would take two flat pieces of steel. On one side, you would engrave half the comb, on the other side, the other half, so that when you put them together, you have an air space the size of the comb plus whatever shrinkage you'll have in the material. Then the hot material is forced into the molding machine, and the mold fills up with the hot material, and there are cooling channels inside the mold, water. And the water is circulated, cooling the part, and then it solidifies, and at an appropriate time you open it up, and there you have a comb in plastic. Now, it's obviously not economical to make one comb. You might want to make 8, 16, as many as 64 combs if you can. So that's fundamentally the process. The way you get the material from the machine, the cylinder, to the comb is through what we call a sprue, S-P-R-U-E, which is just a hole which attaches over the nozzle of the machine so the material doesn't squirt out, and through a system called a runner, which is just that, where the material can run, and then into the part, and it's something we call a gate, G-A-T-E. Gates are two kind. Either they're very small, perhaps 30, 40 thousandths of an inch in diameter, or they're very large, and there are technical reasons for the difference.
Okay. Thank you. Go ahead with your narrative then.
One day when I was giving the lectures, I said somebody ought to write a book on injection molding. And my dear friends at the SPE Journal, which was a publication of the society, all of whom were close friends, you know, it was a very small group, put a little box saying, Reuben is writing a book on injection molding. And I wrote back one of my famous letters telling them where to get off. And if they want to have the title of editor, they're supposed to check what the information they put in. And about 2 months later, there's another squib. Rubin has confirmed the fact that he's writing an injection molding. And I did. I wrote the book. It was a relatively difficult job, because when you start to teach something and write something, you have to answer a lot of questions. And my first question was, unto whom will I write? Who's my audience? And I determined it should be anybody who high school graduate who could have gone to college. Secondly, it had to be in a way that people can understand it, so that if there's a particular formula which governs something, you not only give the formula, but you explain what the formula is, so if you're not mathematically inclined, you can understand what goes on. Secondly, I wrote the book as a businessman as well, because the purpose of molding is to make money, and it's not a theoretical exercise. And thirdly, I wrote it from a safety point of view. I would have written a totally different book, which would not have been too successful, I don't think, had I not been lecturing to people in the industry. And these were people, most of whom had at least 1 degree, sometimes more than 1 degree. And their knowledge was just abysmal. They would learn in college, for example, that we're going to study friction. So they knew the formula for friction and all the questions were friction, so you just plug in the numbers. They would never understand it. They knew nothing about chemistry. They actually had a start as if they never had gone to college. For example, they all knew what Hooke's law was by name. Hooke's law says that if you take a material and stretch it, but not enough to break it, and let go, it'll come back to its original position, quote, instantaneously. We know it takes time. They didn't have the vaguest idea what it was. I would stretch a rubber band and let go and say, is this Hooke's law? And they'd look at me. And if you don't understand basic concepts like that, you cannot understand injection molding. All materials obey Hooke's law. But in plastic, there's another variation, because defining a plastic is simple. A plastic is a large molecule. Now, large molecules have a different chemical cohesion than small molecules, because you have what's known as Brownian movement, which says that all parts of the molecule are moving. So when you have a big, huge molecule with branches all over, the branches entwine, and that's what gives it part of the strength. Now, in each one of the branches, each one of the atoms have Hookean elasticity. But if you move the whole atom, you no longer have that elasticity, because you're displacing the atom. So in plastic, you have a combination of Hookean elasticity, and also you have a movement of the molecules, which you can't predict. And another thing which makes plastic molding so difficult is when they make the plastic by starting with a monomer, which is a basic component, and polymerizing it, there are no two pellets in the world that are the same. So what you get is you get a fraction of the batch that they made, and they blend the fractions to give you as homogeneous a material as you can. But you can't apply quantitative reasoning when you don't have the same material all the time. That compares with, say, copper or iron or whatever. You know the composition, it's going to be the same no matter what. So when I wrote the book, I went back to basic fundamentals. Put it in terms that wouldn't insult my audience. And when I was all done, I realized that while I had great material in there, I did not have the ability to write well. So I hired one of my friends, Lou Natterman, who was the editor of SPE Journal, and for a fee he rewrote the whole thing. He knew it technically, he didn't change the content, but he rearranged the order, put it into good English, so really it reads now like Gone with the Wind. And I read it myself, and I know I didn't write it. But what I had to do is I had to do a lot of experimenting in my own plant, because I did not know answers. They would ask me, for example, how much force do you need to hold the mold together when you're injecting material? Well, I didn't know. So I ran a batch of experiments, had my friends do the same thing, and I came up with an answer, 2.5 tons per square inch of projected area, which has worked for God knows how many years. and I didn't know the energy exchange of a machine. So I put all kinds of meters on it, recorded temperatures, did the whole, you know, we took a lot of physics in college, built a calorimeter to see how much heat came out of the, came out in the plastic itself. And I got a good energy balance of a machine, and I kept on doing things like that.